Welcome to the Wild Animals Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Roland Hayes, a professor at North Carolina State University, a scientist at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. Now, I'm an animal tracker, and I know how amazing it is to get to know a wild animal personally. To be out there in the woods, following them around, learning their routines, get to meet their friends, their enemies, and get a taste of the real-world drama happening in animal societies every day. In this podcast, I share this drama with you by interviewing other scientists to meet the characters they've discovered while studying wild animals. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Wild Animals. Today, we've got F202, the Yellowstone cougar, who showed the value of protected areas. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. Today, I've got Colby Anton. He's a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Montana, and he's going to talk about F202, the Yellowstone cougar who showed the value of protected area. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So cougars, mountain lions, pumas, they're all the same thing, and you studied them. In Yellowstone, we're talking about, but before that, you studied them in California, I think, right?
I've helped out with some of the projects in California and then as well in Southwest Colorado.
Okay. And what do they call them in California?
I think I've heard puma and mountain lion tend to be more common there.
Yeah.
And then if you move up to, you know, Northeast, it tends to be more like catamount or, all sorts of different names.
Yeah, I like a cougar. We'll stick with that.
And yeah, let's do that.
Tell us a little bit about mountain lions in general for those who aren't familiar.
Yeah, so they're primarily a solitary species, although they do interact with other members of their community. They're one of the larger carnivores that we have in North America, and they're extremely widespread. So they can be found all the way up to southern Yukon, all the way down through the tip of South America. And so they have one of the widest distributions of a land mammal in the Western Hemisphere.
It contributes to having so many different names, I guess.
Yes, totally.
Right. Yep. And so Yellowstone sounds like the coolest place in the world to study cougars. So what was your, I guess there's lots of cool places, but what was the sort of objectives of the project?
Yeah. So it is a really great place to study large carnivores because there has a really dense population of multiple different carnivore species. We started this study in 2014, and we were coming in on the heels of a few other research programs that had already studied cougars in the area. So cougars were, they kind of reintroduced themselves to Yellowstone Park. Everybody talks about the wolf reintroduction. Yeah. Cougars were actually largely extirpated from the park in the, around the same time, 1920s. And they started to come back over the years. There were sightings of tracks or scat. And then we started to see a lot more animals coming back around the late 1980s, early 80s to late 80s. Mm. And so Kerry Murphy was the first cougar researcher in Yellowstone, and he started a study in 1988. And he did about a six-year study looking primarily at just population numbers, how many cougars there were. But he was also looking at interactions with other grizzly bears, as well as looking at some of their predator-prey dynamics. So there was a little bit of a break there in cougar research. And then the wolf reintroduction happened in 95, 96. And then another cougar researcher came back. This next project was led by Tony Ruth. And this was another 6-7 year project that started in 1997. And that was coming back and gave this opportunity to look at, how do cougars respond to a much more dominant large carnivore, wolves coming back on the landscape, and how that would then affect them. That went through to the mid-2000s. Then there was a long break. And what we noticed is that some of the dynamics in the system had changed. The wolf population had largely stabilized. Mm-hmm. Grizzly bears had been increasing. Some of the elk population had changed. And so we wanted to know what's going on with cougars at that point. And so a couple of our objectives were primarily to look at how many cougars there were. So we wanted to know density and abundance. And we wanted to know if the population was declining or increasing or stabilized at the moment. And one of the other main objectives we wanted to look at is how their diet had changed since the two previous cougar studies. Because as I said before, some of the different prey species, primarily elk and mule deer, those populations had changed in the previous 10 years. So we wanted to know if the cougar diet had responded to those changes.
What did you think the diet would change? How did you think the diet would change?
Well, we expected that deer would comprise a bit more of their diet than it had previously.
And less what?
Less elk. In the second cougar study, we were looking at most closer to about 60 to 75% elk in their diet.
Oh, wow.
And then the rest is primarily mule deer. You also get white-tailed deer, sheep, the occasional goat, if they happen to find one, and then a bunch of smaller species like red fox and coyote, marmots, porcupine.
So a cougar will kill and eat a coyote?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Huh. Yeah.
Interesting.
And largely, we think these probably happen at carcass sites. And so a coyote is coming in to try to get some scavenge.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep. And
so
they
what
get
about
caught.
Porcupines, man? Cougars will kill porcupines?
Yes, they will.
How do they do it?
We have never seen it, but we believe there are some videos of, leopards doing this in Africa.
Okay.
And so we think that mountain lions are probably using a similar technique where they'll take their paws and their claws. They have retractile claws. And so they'll take their claws out and they'll try to flip the porcupine over.
Yeah.
And it's their belly that's the spot that they want to try to attack. And
wow.
So
interesting.
Yep.
So the porcupine's probably spinning around and trying to jab them.
Yeah.
That would be interesting to see.
It would be very interesting. We actually captured a mountain lion in Yellowstone that was on a porcupine kill at the time of capture.
Okay.
And so she had quills all in her face, palate, in her tongue, all in her paws.
In her paws?
In her paws. It was pretty interesting.
Because, I mean, if you can't get them out, you're walking around with
totally.
A quill
yeah.
in your hand. That'd be terrible.
Yep. We ended up following her for a couple of years. So she must have gotten them out.
Okay.
We took out as many as we could during the time of capture too. Yeah. We figure we might as well help her
out. Yeah. It'd be hard not to do that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you're using probably updated technology from the previous, studies.
Certainly.
Right? So most of your project was in catching the cougars, giving them some kind of collar and letting them go.
Yeah.
What was the collar like?
It was certainly an updated collar. Some of the previous work relied primarily on VHF collars, which you have to go out and be on the ground and catch their signal. Much harder to get a really precise location. But we were using GPS Iridium collars. And so you can get a GPS location anywhere from every 5 minutes to every couple of days. And it has a precision of about 30 meters on the ground. So really precise. And we had this added function that we wanted to do on our collars of a triaxial accelerometer.
Okay.
So they're measuring movement of the three main axes of the body. And you can do some really cool things with the accelerometer data that comes back. It's measuring the movement of the animal at a really high rate. So ours, we're measuring it at 16 times a second.
Oh, wow.
Continuously as the collar is out.
Continuously. Wow. And so the Iridium part is the satellite that's sending the GPS data.
Yes.
But then I guess the accelerometer, that's too much data to send, right?
Certainly. Yeah. So the accelerometer data, since it is so much data, that's just stored on the collar. And then once we get the collar back, we get to look at the gold mine of accelerometer data.
Kind of an exciting.
It is.
Exciting time. So when you, let's say when you see the graph of of accelerometer data of like a mountain lion walking,
yeah.
What does that look like?
Yeah, so you end up picking up the footfalls of the animal.
Right.
So you get the almost like a, if you think of like an EKG where somebody's looking at your heart rate and you get those little
rhythmic stepping.
Boom. Yep. So if the animal's walking at a pretty solid pace, you'll just kind of get those footfalls. Boom, 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 boom. And that comes out in the accelerometer.
Right. And then when they're running,
then all
of a sudden you can see the
it starts to get pretty crazy. The collar is just going every which direction
when they're running.
Yeah.
And then what about when they attack something?
Yeah. So this was, one of the things that we were really interested in is, can we use the accelerometer to help us detect, kills, when the animal, and then also when the animal's feeding. And so you can see that. What's really cool with cougars, and they've done this also in Santa Cruz with, mountain lions there as well. But you can actually see the animal kind of sitting and waiting, and the accelerometer data shows the animal not moving at all. And then all of a sudden you see this really large spike. We call it a surge.
Wow.
And the surge is some of the highest acceleration that you see from the accelerometer data.
That's the pounce.
That's the big pounce. And they're literally, leaping through the air or bounding as hard as they possibly can towards this animal. And it's that surge, and you can pick it up. And what's really cool about that too is as the prey species get bigger, the surges also get bigger. And so, you know, mountain lions are
well, cougars. But it's not, the surge isn't just one leap. It's a leap and then it's a battle.
Exactly.
Right? Fight to the death.
Exactly. Yep. Oh my God. And hopefully for the cougar, it's short. That's their goal is they want that surge to be as short as possible. Because it's, it costs a lot of energy to do that really high acceleration movement. It's also really dangerous to take down, prey species
sure.
too.
Right. So much drama in one graph.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. And it's really cool to start thinking about, you know, you're looking at this graph, of course, and starting to think of putting yourself in the animal's shoes in that moment and
right.
try to think about what they're looking at that moment.
Right. Right. Well, so, you're not just like getting all this data. I mean, so you are getting in all the data at the end, right? Mm-hmm. When the collar falls off.
Yep.
But you're also like out there in the field while the data is coming in, doing some, like following the animals around, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so we wanted to use the accelerometer on the back end to kind of truth what we were seeing from being on the ground. So every couple of weeks for a few seasons throughout the year, we would do a GPS cluster analysis to look at what cougars were eating for that time period. And so what that would mean is we were just taking clusters of multiple GPS locations that were in a small area over space and time. And we would hike to every single one of these clusters and we would look for prey remains.
Wow.
And then try to dissect also kind of what had happened at that site. Maybe how the cougar was hiding in a bush, where it maybe would have pounced. And if they dragged the animal, where they would have dragged it from. And so, we took pretty detailed notes of some of these kill sites and tried to piece it back together with the accelerometer later see if we can match up some of those behaviors.
That's pretty cool. So you're sort of riding around Yellowstone, getting these like random points, who knows where they are, and you got to go walk there and see what you find.
Yeah.
Did you ever walk up there and like find a grizzly bear on the like finishing off the kill or anything like that?
We tried to avoid that as much as possible, but, inevitably, some of them, there are still animals feeding on the carcass.
Yeah.
So, there can be some sketchy times going out to kill sites.
Have you come in close to grizzlies out there?
We have had some. Yes. Yep. I am, a strong proponent of bear spray.
Yeah.
Bear spray does work. We've used it. It works.
Okay. So you got too close to a bear, or a bear got too close to you, and you had to pull out your bear spray.
Yes. Yep. Yeah.
How did that hit? Like, were you scared? What happened?
I mean, the crazy thing about some of those grizzly bear interactions is they happen so fast.
Yeah.
So, there's almost no time to be scared in the moment.
Right.
Your instincts kind of take over and, we practice a lot taking your bear spray out as fast as possible. And so
are you a quick draw?
Yeah. We used to have these really funny, like quick draw competitions with, empty bear spray cans, of course, but, fun things to do as technicians.
Yeah.
Bear spray is a really great deterrent for, an animal that's
really fast.
So how really
close did the bear get?
Within, probably about 5 to 10 feet from us.
Oh my God.
She had a cub with her,
ooh, yeah.
which tends to be, more of the aggressive interactions.
Yeah.
And we had actually seen her down in this meadow. We had run into her the day before. This was on a backcountry trip, picking up an elk collar, from an elk that had died. And, we saw her down in this meadow on our hike out, on the final day. And so we're like, let's let her and her cub just enjoy this awesome mountain meadow down there. Let's go up and around her and see if we could just totally avoid her. Unfortunately, humans just aren't very, quiet. And we're apparently pretty stinky. So we were going up and around. We made too much noise. It piqued her interest. And so she came over to investigate it, but we were around the corner. So by the time she figured out what we were and we saw her, she was already, within 25 feet and, she did not like that. So she started posturing and jumping around, hitting logs. And she would, it was kind of interesting. She would almost bluff charge us. So she'd come towards us really fast and she would look over at her cub and her cub was mirroring all of her behaviors. And so she would almost get close and then she would realize, oh, my cub's too close to these humans. I'm going to back off. And so she'd run back. And then her cub would follow, and then she'd charge back at us again. So she charged about three times, and the third time she got really close enough that we were able to spray her. And
yeah,
she hit the cloud of bear spray and just immediately turned and bolted and ran away.
Oh, man. It's like took a deep breath. And,
yes.
Oh, my God.
Yep.
That's crazy. Well, so we should get on to F202,
yes,
the star of the story today. When did you first meet F202?
Yeah, we had the privilege of meeting F202. We first collared her in 2016.
Okay.
And at the time, we also had a collar on her subadult male son, who was probably around 18 months old at the time.
And so you trapped her.
Each specific animal, of course, has a different approach for how we trap them or catch them. And for mountain lions, where in most places the best way to do it is with trained hounds. So we have a trained houndsman. So this is a guy that we hire that has, this is kind of what he does in all of his free time, is he has trained hounds. And so he came out with two hounds, we would hike down a drainage and hope that we hit some fresh cougar tracks. And when we do, we let the dogs go on the tracks themselves.
Yeah.
And the dogs use the visual cue of the track line itself and then the smell of the scent of the cougar.
Sure.
And they're able to chase the animal down and tree the cougar. And then they wait down at the bottom of the tree barking for us to show up. And what we found is usually for about every 15 to 30 minutes, the dogs are ahead of us. We're a couple hours out from where they are because they're so fast and able to move through that snow.
So you guys are like trucking it, trying to keep, this is in the winter too.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. Okay. We are
skis.
Usually hiking.
Yeah.
So post-holing our way through deep snow sometimes to get to the tree as fast as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. And with a tranquilizer gun ready to go. And,
yes.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. We've got all of our gear on our back and, yep, got all of our supplies.
And so where was F202 living within the Yellowstone Park?
Yeah, so F202 was residing right in the center of our study area in the northern part of Yellowstone Park, in an area near the outlet of Hell Roaring Creek, where Hell Roaring hits the Yellowstone River.
Okay.
It's a really great spot with a lot of really good grazing grounds for prey species.
Cool. So what did you learn about her from the from the GPS tracking? Like, how big was her range, or what was she doing, and how'd she make a living? Was she eating deer or elk?
Yes.
All the above?
All the above. She had a really varied diet. It changed a little bit by season. She had a relatively, a common home range size, about 10 square kilometers.
Okay.
And that's pretty average for an adult female cougar. And she primarily fed on elk. It's the most abundant prey species in her home range. But she would also feed on deer. We found multiple red fox kills by her, and a lot of marmot kills too in the summertime.
Huh. What does a cougar leave left of a marmot?
Usually just the face, or sometimes a paw. You maybe find a pelvis.
Yeah.
Usually with these really small prey species, you're looking for very small pieces left.
And so when you go back and look at the GPS data, did you find, like, I presume, like, the marmot must be a pretty small cluster of
it is.
Like, how long will they hang out on a marmot?
Couple points. So, maybe an hour, sometimes as long as 4 or 5 hours.
Okay. So it's just a snack.
It is. Yeah. It's just a snack. However, what was interesting about F202, we came into it thinking that marmots were just a snack and it couldn't possibly provide enough sustenance to live off of. But after F202, so this is kind of jumping forward in time.
Yeah, sure.
So at the time of capture, she had 3 yearlings. Cougars will stay with their mother for anywhere from about 1 year to 2 years of time, with the average being about 18 months.
Okay.
And so, a few months after capturing F202, all of her yearlings left. And soon after, about a month after, she gave birth to a whole new litter. And she had four new kittens. This was in the summer of 2016.
Jeez.
And so soon after she had her kittens, her home range size really contracted. So she stayed pretty close to her nursery site. And she would just kind of do short forays out from there. And for a long time, this was about a 2 to 3 week period, she primarily subsisted on marmots, right around her nursery site. And we were, we kept going out to these cluster sites thinking, when are we going to find a deer? She couldn't possibly be only eating marmots. Yeah. And it just kept being a marmot, 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 marmot. So, they're big enough, I guess, to give them that ability.
Yeah.
To,
well, so in that case, she can't go out for a long hunt because she's got kittens.
Exactly. Back. Yeah. Yeah. She's got to come back and nurse.
Yeah. Where was her den? Do you know?
Yeah. So her nursery site, we ended up doing a nursery site visit to, get some genetics from her kittens.
Oh, so you pulled out the super cute,
yes,
little
we
mountain
did.
Lion kittens. Oh my God. Yeah. Do they have blue eyes?
They do. Yep. They're born with blue eyes. They're born with, spots too.
Right.
And those spots will subside as the animals age. And they're, you know, just a few pounds at birth. For the first few weeks, they don't really come out of the nursery site.
Yeah.
This particular nursery site was at the base of a cliff in a huge jumble of rocks. So a lot of big, kind of mixed between big and small rocks. So a big talus field.
Okay.
And she found this little kind of cave that she could, get all the way in, and it went back maybe 3 feet, 5 feet.
Did you crawl in there and pull out the kittens?
It did, yeah.
And someone's hopefully watching your back. To make
yes,
sure she
definitely.
Show up.
Yep, and since she had the collar on, we were monitoring where she... So we waited for her to leave.
Okay.
We monitored the nursery site for a couple of weeks prior, and we wanted to go in at a point when the kittens were about 6 weeks old.
Okay. So she was off on a hunt. She wasn't near.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, she was off, and we'd come out, but once she hit about 6 weeks old, the kittens hit 6 weeks old, we came back out every day to check her signal on her radio collar to see where she was. And once she was gone, we went in and looked at the kittens.
Cool.
And they
cool.
all looked very healthy. She had two males, two females. Pretty common that they get 50% each.
Yeah. So how's the survival of the kittens? What's that like? That must be that's usually the riskiest time, right?
Certainly. Yeah. The first 6 months, that's when the highest mortality happens. In Yellowstone, though, we have pretty good survival for kittens, even though they're faced with a gauntlet of different things that can hurt them. You know, there's black bears, grizzly bears, and coyotes, and wolves, and they're all looking for them. But for her particular litter, three of the four ended up making it all the way to dispersal age.
Okay,
so that's pretty good.
Yeah,
we don't know how many kittens of the previous litter she had, but she also had. Three animals dispersed.
Right. So is she breeding like every 2 years?
Just about. Yeah. So cougars are unique that they can breed any time of the year. There's no specific breeding time. And pretty much as soon as their kittens disperse or she loses her kittens, she's capable of breeding immediately.
Wow. And so how many litters did you follow with her?
We were only able, since we caught her pretty late in life, she was around 8 years old when we caught her.
Okay.
We were able to watch these last two litters for her.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we have no doubt that she had many litters before that and contributed.
Yeah. So if she was eight, she probably had, another three litters before that? Or
yes,
something like
probably.
That.
Yeah.
So kind of a super mom.
Yes, definitely.
To basically constantly either pregnant or nursing.
Yes.
And then pregnant, nursing.
Yeah, it's a big deal to be raising kittens in Yellowstone.
Right. But so you mentioned one of her offspring you had collared as well, a male, right?
Yes.
And he kind of had a different fate. Tell
us
about him.
Yeah, so this was M201. He was also collared around the same time F202 was collared. And that May, so we captured them in February and March, and that May, he ended up dispersing. All three of the kittens dispersed. And we, since he had the GPS collar, we were able to follow his route and see where he went. And he also had an accelerometer on, and we were able to see when he was able to start making his own kills on his own. Because that's, of course, one of the big scares as a mountain lion leaves their mother for the first time, are they capable of feeding themselves after that point? And so we were happy to see that he was more than capable of feeding himself. Within 2 weeks of leaving his mom, he made an adult elk kill all by himself. We knew he was going to be okay.
Yeah.
But he ended up dispersing north of the park, kind of up Slough Creek, and then cut all the way to the east and traveled almost the entire eastern boundary towards the east entrance. It was a pretty long way, maybe 50, 60 miles at least. Mm-hmm. At that point, he hit some human development over there. So then he ended up bouncing north into an area that's called Sunlight Basin. And this is just outside the park in Wyoming. Mm-hmm. And he was there for a few months, setting up what seemed to be a more permanent home range. We were able to go over and search some of his GPS clusters. We're finding him. He killed an adult mule deer buck that ended up getting taken over by a black bear.
Oh, yeah.
So things look pretty promising for him. But as we know, as animals leave some of these protected areas, management schemes change, and their overall protection changes too. And so, M201 was legally harvested, that first year that he was out there in December 2016.
Someone trapped him or shot
him. Yep. They probably used hounds, like we do for capture, used hounds and were able to shoot him in
the tree.
Did you
get the collar back?
We did. Yep.
Okay. So they turned it in. It was legal. It's allowed.
Yep. 100% legal.
It was outside the boundary of Yellowstone.
Yes. Outside the boundary, probably about 20 miles east of the park. So, well outside the boundary, completely legal hunt. And it was somebody that had paid an outfitter. They went out with an outfitter and harvested M201.
Did you tell them like the history of this animal, where it came from, or?
Yes, they were extremely interested in, they actually wanted to buy the collar from us because they were so interested in it. We said, no, there's accelerometer data on there. We really want that collar back.
So there's no hunting in Yellowstone. And then once you get out Yellowstone, there's going to be sort of local laws about what seasons and how many animals you can hunt and the method you can use and all that kind of
stuff. Exactly.
But I guess if I was a hunter that was looking for mountain lions, I would look pretty close to Yellowstone, right?
Because you have
animals like F202 that are pumping out these litters, living in great habitat, having three or four young every couple of years. And so kind of a source population. And then potentially a sink population, I guess, as you get outside.
That's exactly what's going on, Roland. There was a paper that came out in 2010 that quantified that and did identify the park as a source and the surrounding area specifically to the north as a sink population specifically for cougars.
Yeah. Well, and I know I've seen in the news that this becomes an issue for the wolves as well, right?
Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so can you talk a little, I know you weren't studying the wolves, but how?
Yeah. So same idea, Yellowstone ends up having a higher pup survival than some of the surrounding areas. And so, it ends up providing more animals that can disperse to the surrounding area or in other parts of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. And so wolves often take very similar routes that cougars take on their dispersal routes, and end up coming into contact with humans. And they can also be legally harvested outside of the park.
So are there populations of wolves and cougars outside the park that are breeding and surviving?
Yes.
Okay. So the hunters aren't killing them all?
No, they're not killing them all. What we do see is some of the populations, not all of them, but some of them are lower density than what we see inside the park.
Okay. That makes sense.
And that's because, we are sending, there's all of those. Since it is the source population, there's a surplus of animals, higher density inside the park to send outside.
Right. But then sometimes they might find another protected area.
Oh, yeah, right? Definitely. And a lot of them also, they leave the park and they set up a home range and they're fine.
Yeah.
Not all animals leave the park and perish.
Yeah.
But their probability of survival declines as they leave the park.
Right. Right. Well, I saw in the news this year that I think it was this year or last year that it looks like wolves have newly colonized Colorado.
Right.
And
yeah.
And they had a litter this year, I think. And so oh, I was wow. like, that must be a Yellowstone wolf, right? That's the nearest population.
It's, yeah. Well, maybe not. Very likely.
Yellowstone, greater Yellowstone area yep. wolf that sort of made it through a bunch of area that didn't have wolves. It must have been two of them because they had a litter.
Right.
And sort of found a protected area in Colorado. And it was super interesting to me because Colorado had actually just voted
right.
to reintroduce
yeah,
them.
Right.
So they were going to like manually bring them in. And it turns out the wolves made it there on their own.
Beat them to it.
Yeah.
Pretty that's cool. Really cool.
Maybe they'll get a collar on that one and we can hear that story later.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah,
I hope so.
Well, so let's go back to F202. She had another litter, and then what happened next?
Yeah, so F202 in 2016 had another litter.
Safe inside the middle of the park.
Exactly, yep. We were able to just kind of watch her move through this kind of next stage of her life. So she had young kittens. We call them young kittens until they hit about 6 months of age. And at that point, they start to really expand their home range, travel farther. The kittens are really traveling with mom full time at that point.
Right.
So, the nursery site is a distant memory at that point. They're traveling wherever mom goes.
Yeah.
Mom will often stash the kittens somewhere. In a juniper bush, even something really yeah. simple, and then go off on her hunt,
okay.
come back, bring the kittens to the kill to feed.
So do tourists ever get to see this? Because
oh, yeah,
I was a tourist in Yellowstone and I didn't see any mountain lions.
I mean, extremely rare, but there right. are the very lucky tourists that show up and you get to see a mountain lion from the road.
Right. Yeah.
But extremely yeah. rare. In the years of tracking them, it was pretty often that I would have their signal. I know exactly where they are and I still could not see them.
Wow.
And they're just amazing at finding little cubbies to hide in.
Yeah. Yeah. Cats are so secretive.
Yes. Yeah. Very cool. We just ended up watching, F202 with her kittens, move through the landscape. We watched her home range. At that point, we weren't, completely, we didn't know exactly where she was going to go at all parts of the year. So we just kind of watched and saw that her home range, stayed pretty consistent throughout the year, mm-hmm. Primarily there in the hell roaring area. Most of the three of the four kittens survived all the way to dispersal age.
Yeah.
She was another successful litter
but
for her.
But she didn't breed then next, right? What happened?
So she didn't breed. So, we of course waited and, we have males also collared in the area. We also have a ton of remote cameras up that yeah. we're monitoring. And so we would actually see her pop up on remote cameras, sometimes with a male, sometimes
okay.
by herself. And so we're thinking, she's found a male to breed with. We're probably going to see her set up a nursery site sometime soon.
Yeah.
But we never saw her set up a nursery site again. She just continued to travel and move around.
At this point, she's getting pretty old.
She is.
For a cougar, right?
For a cougar, it's, on average, we're looking at around like 6 to 8 is an older cougar, especially yeah. in Yellowstone. Outside the park, they rarely even make it to that age.
Okay.
It's, 4 to 5 is an older cougar outside mm-hmm. the park. At a certain point, it becomes too energetically costly at that age to produce young. And, the gestation is really energetically costly.
Yeah.
Then lactation is very energetically costly. And then, of course, going out and killing surplus prey in order to feed your
yeah.
kittens is also extremely costly. So, we believe at that point in her life, she deemed it. She was just gonna, live out the rest of her life without kittens.
Yeah. And so, when's the last time? Like what happened?
Yeah. So, we actually ended up capturing her one more time.
Okay.
So we wanted to swap out the collar. The collar
oh, right,
run out of battery. Get the accelerometer back. We're always really scared of the battery on the collar dying, and then we never get the accelerometer data back.
Yeah.
So. We captured her again in 2018.
Okay.
So this was 2 years later. And what was really interesting at this point is how different she looked at that point. So this was after her kittens had dispersed.
Yeah.
She had lost a lot of weight at that point. Mm. The other interesting thing too, she had lost the tip of her tail. So we think she probably suffered some frostbite in a really cold freeze during the winter. She lost the tip of her tail. She also ended up losing a couple more of her canines. Uh-oh. So her teeth.
Yeah. Well, that's a bad sign when you make a living with your teeth.
Exactly. You know, those are the most important tools in her toolbox that she has. And so, at that time, she was left with only one canine.
Oh.
And so, as you can imagine, that makes it one hard to grasp and hold on to prey.
Yeah.
But also pretty hard to feed as well.
Yeah.
Because she, beyond her canines, she had also lost a lot of her other teeth.
Yeah. So the writing was kind of on the wall at that point.
It was. Yep. And so a couple, about a year, 2 years later in 2020, we ended up finding her dead in Yellowstone. And
okay.
She had just found a nice spot to lay down. And yeah.
And she just, she wasn't predated by anything. She
was
just,
not predated.
Just she kind of died of old age.
Died of old age, which wow. is, you know, one of the best case scenarios you can hope for.
It's a luxury for a wild animal.
It is.
Right? To imagine, and again, it kind of shows the value of living in a protected area. That
yeah.
You could live out, have what, 3 or 4 litters or 5 litters or something like that.
Yeah.
Over a lifespan, probably. And then just die of old age and then probably replaced by one of her daughters or something
exactly.
like that.
Right? Exactly. That is a very likely scenario. So it's, we were, you know, sad to see F202 go, of course, but very happy to have learned so much from her.
Yeah. And so she lives on in mounds and mounds of accelerometry data.
Exactly. GPS data, I guess. Billions of lines of accelerometer data.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then did you say you saved her skull?
We did. We saved her skull and we do this with all of the dead animals that we find in Yellowstone. We end up saving their skulls and we send them to this pathologist that ends up doing a lot more kind of in-depth detail look that, okay. at their skulls to look at things that have happened throughout their lifetime. Even.
Right. Look at all the broken teeth.
Exactly. And that's one of the primary things that he was so shocked to see was just how bad her teeth were at the time of death. And yeah. he attributed her death primarily to how bad her teeth were.
Okay.
So she was just going to be at that point struggling to eat and be able to kill prey.
So is she in a museum now? Or do you know what they do with her skull?
The skull is probably sitting in an office up high on a shelf.
Okay.
catching some sun, hopefully.
Yeah.
yeah.
Well, cool. Well, that's really cool. Thanks for sharing the story of F202, the cougar who showed the value of a protected area, and her son who showed the risks of leaving
yes.
a protected area.
Yep.
Really cool to hear a Yellowstone tale like this.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Will.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of Wild Animals Podcast. If you like this, be sure to check out the Wild Animals YouTube channel, where we tell visual stories about wild animals using camera trap footage. Special thanks for production help in this podcast from Eben Crawford, and for support from the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences and North Carolina State University.